Tax Update for Saturday, July 22nd, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, July 22nd, 2006. This week, the tax gap, FASB speaks on tax liabilities. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in the presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such a prohibited use would include using the podcast or the supporting documents as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. This week, we break from looking at some of the tax-related matters to actually going over to an accounting and auditing topic. Now, before those of you who are not CPAs or even CPAs who say, I don't do A&A work, start tuning out, we're going to talk about this issue because it's going to have an impact, I think, on people far more than just the accounting and auditing CPAs out there or the CPAs who are doing compilations and reviews. We're going to see a lot of issues that come in because of the interaction between a recent interpretation that the Financial Accounting Standards Board released on the issue of accounting for income taxes and income tax practice in the United States, especially for closely held companies. In June, the Financial Accounting Standards Board released Financial Accounting Standards Interpretation Number 48. Interpretation Number 48 dealt with essentially an interpretation of the FASB 109 that was dealing with the accounting for income taxes. Now, those of us who have been in tax practice know that FASB 109 has always been kind of an interesting aside and one of those things that was kind of difficult to work with. But what this interpretation is dealing with, to be honest, is now a response to the tax shelter industry, and that response is becoming involved with the financial accounting world because of most likely concerns, to be quite honest, that the accounting profession perhaps was involved in both selling the tax shelters in the marketed tax shelter arena and involved with the examinations of the financial audits. We have now got a slightly different or a very different set of rules that will apply to potential contingent liabilities related to taxes than apply to contingent liabilities related to anything else. So we're going to take a look at this ruling and also look at potentially the consequences of this ruling for those of us who are in regular ordinary practice and the problems and issues it's going to bring up. Now, the FASB interpretations are copyrighted documents, so there is not a copy of FASB interpretation number 48 in the materials for this podcast. However, I have the link to the information over on the FASB website. You can go to their website. You're looking for interpretation number 48. Now, interpretation number 48 goes on for 58 pages, but much of that involves examples and involves justifications for the methods and for the items that are required under FASB 48. The actual interpretation is relatively short and deals with a few straightforward areas. What we're going to discover is the problem is not so much this is a difficult interpretation to understand. It's an interpretation that's going to introduce us some real problems in practice. Now, as noted, why do we have a change here? Well, FASB justifies this by noting there have been different, they think, standards applied in reporting tax return positions on financial statements. Their concern has been, and probably the unstated concern is, that if a tax shelter product was promoted by an accounting firm, that accounting firm was auditing, they might have a relatively low standard as which they would agree that this was an appropriate tax provision on the return. Now, FASB also, quite honestly, probably looks at this as slightly different than other contingent liabilities because your income tax provision is a self-computed liability. It's self-assessed. So the entity in question is assessing its own income tax and puts that down and therefore is computing its own number. As such, FASB seems to believe now that we should have a different standard for what we need to do in terms of potential challenges to that number that's being reported as a tax liability on the financial statement than we do, for instance, to potential claims from outsiders for, let's say, product liability or pension plan underfunding or other such issues that may very well be coming assertions from the outside for claims against us. A key issue to note is that this now takes the issues of accounting for contingent liability for taxes out of the standard under SFAS number 5, the old FASB 5 standard for liabilities for contingencies. Remember, under the contingency rules, we generally only had to book a liability if it was probable that the liability would be asserted and we could basically come up with a number that would be asserted, then we would record the liability. If it was merely possible, reasonably possible, that the liability would come forward or might be asserted, we had to disclose it, and if the possibility was deemed remote, and that remote possibility could be even because we didn't believe a claim would be asserted, then no disclosure and no booking of the amount involved had to take place on the financial statement. Note that in this case, we basically have to get to a fairly high standard in order to require us to recognize that potential liability. As well, we also need to be able to take a look at the fact that we have disclosure on a lower level, but our basic presumption is that we can go ahead and say we're going to presume the claim will not be raised. We're going to presume the claim will not be raised potentially because nobody will ever uncover the claim. The person won't become in possession of all the necessary facts. That's potentially a reason why the claim wouldn't be there. But for whatever reason, we essentially can take a look and decide the claim will not be raised, even, and it could simply be because nobody will be in possession of all the facts in a timely manner that would allow the claim to be raised. Now, we are going to face a very different rule here. Under this interpretation, you are not allowed to recognize a tax benefit from a tax return position unless you believe it is more likely than not you will obtain that benefit. And if the benefit is one that's kind of on a sliding scale, where we don't know what the benefit will be, you have to recognize only that benefit for which there is a greater than 50% chance as of basically the end of the accounting period that you believe, based on your information available at that date, there is a greater than 50% chance you would be able to keep, assuming you were examined and assuming the examining agent was basically in possession of all relevant details. A key issue becomes, first, what is the definition of a tax position? Because tax positions are what we worry about. And paragraph 4 of Interpretation 48 provides that a tax position refers to a position in a previously filed tax return or a position expected to be taken in a future return that is reflected in measuring current or deferred income taxes and liabilities for interim or annual periods. So basically, it's anything that appears on a tax return and any position taken. Now, it's a circular definition of sorts, since a tax position is a position. But I think what you clearly are driving at here is that anything you put on that return is a position. You take a position that, for instance, the wages you paid your employees are deductible expenses. You take a position that you can take 179 expense on that piece of equipment that you put into play. Those are all positions. And we get benefits from those positions. There is a tax benefit from being able to deduct our employees' wages. There is a tax benefit from being able to claim the Section 179 deduction. That benefit, though, can only be recognized against income. We can only reduce our tax provision based on that benefit if we are convinced we have a greater than 50% chance of being able to keep it. This comes down to when to recognize the benefits, and this is found in paragraph 6. There is a more likely than not analysis, which is a substantially higher standard than the standard required to be able to take a position on a return or even to be required to disclose that position on the return and be able to escape penalties in that provision. In essence, we can have a lower than a 50% standard and not be in trouble here. You may notice this more likely than not standard seems to duplicate, and in some ways does duplicate, the standard we see in Circular 230 for covered opinions. I suspect it is not a coincidence that we see the linking of these two provisions, because both of them related to the marketed tax shelter arena were at least driving forces behind both of these. Now, in paragraph 7 of the interpretation, we're told how to do the more likely than not analysis, and they provide us with basically three criterion. The first criterion, which sounds very similar to what we find in Circular 230, is it shall be presumed the tax position will be examined by the relevant taxing authority and that they have full knowledge of all relevant information. Now, that is similar to Circular 230. You are not allowed to discount this or remove it from the financial statement or ignore the issue because the IRS just simply would never examine this. Let's say, for instance, you have a position that you expect would not be examined for various reasons. You're in an area where the IRS simply has never done exams. They don't examine this area. And despite the fact that our position probably wouldn't stand up if looked at, there's virtually no chance it'll be looked at. That is not a relevant reason not to make the adjustment under this provision. You cannot have any consideration of the fact the service may not look at the issue or that the service would not have access to all relevant information. They might not be competent to pull that together. You're going to presume it is pulled together. Now, they go on in B to tell us the technical merits of a tax position, and they give us a source of authority in tax law, which includes legislation and statutes, legislative intent, regulation, rulings, and case law, and their applicability to the facts and circumstances of the tax position. Now, the one point that goes on here that may be a little more useful and is a little bit broader than we see in Circular 230 is the next sentence. When the past administrative practices and precedents of the taxing authority in its dealings with the enterprise or similar enterprises are widely understood, these practices and precedents shall be taken into account. Now, that's a little different than we saw under Circular 230, where you couldn't presume the IRS would simply get rid of the position or not pursue the position on appeals. They wouldn't move forward. This is a case where apparently you can make the assumption about what the IRS is likely to do because of what they've done in the past regarding these types of positions, at least with similar enterprises or with your own expectation, your own experiences with the IRS when they've dealt with this area. That opens up a little bit of a hole that doesn't appear to be there in Circular 230. And finally, under C, each tax position must be evaluated without consideration of the possibility of offset or aggregation with other positions. You cannot say, well, we'd lose here, but we'd probably get a benefit over there, therefore we can ignore it in total because in total it's not material. What they're telling you is each position stands on its own, and you can't ignore this position because you believe there is another position that would go the other way and you'd end up with no liability at the end of the day. You have to evaluate all positions together. Now, as I say, the key issue here is different than Circular 230. It does not appear we have to presume we're going to litigate all the way to the United States Supreme Court in making our more likely than not determination. We apparently can accept the fact that the IRS at the appellate level would make certain compromises if we have reason to believe that is valid. Under the Circular 230 regulations for covered opinions, you're not allowed to make such assumptions in general. Now, the 50% test is kind of interesting. We apply that 50% test at each reporting period, and we reconsider what items might change our view about our greater than 50% limitation. Now, one key issue to remember as we see paragraph 10 of the statement or of the interpretation is noticed at issue C of paragraph 10, the expiration of the statute of limitations is an issue you consider. If you think about that, that's correct. If the statute has expired and the IRS cannot raise the issue short of now claiming fraud, then, and there is not fraud, fraud would not be carried, then that obviously impacts the odds of getting the benefit. What this means is that certain uncertain positions are going to essentially be put on a 3-year delay into your financial statement. Now, the math of this provision is such that you up front book the potential liability. At the back end, when the liability goes away, you're going to reduce your provision for income taxes by the fact you've now gained this liability. You've now gained this provision because the IRS failed to examine you. As well, note that at paragraphs A21 to A24, back in the examples, they show that you can use a probability assessment in determining what level to record. That is, I can consider the fact that on exam, I would expect to settle out at X dollars for my benefit, therefore that's my liability, and I can change that based on history and expectation. Another interesting example is found at A31 to A32 of the interpretation, which indicates that if we have a case decided that, let's say in the example in question, we have a tax position, we believe we would be sustained, but after the end of our year, but before we issue our financial statements, we discover that another enterprise with a very similar position has now lost a case in court, let's say a case in our circuit that would apply to us, and it now appears that that changes our mind and reduces our confidence in this provision to below 50%. That's all well and good, and what FASB tells you in the theoretical sense there is that's irrelevant. You would still continue on the prior year not to record and recognize that change in your expectation. You would record that change in expectation in the year in which you had the adverse decision that had now changed your mind about your ability to sustain the position. Now, as a practical matter, this opens you up to a lot of second guessing because obviously the fact that it went to court and lost could cause a plaintiff's attorney to argue that your initial evaluation clearly was flawed and that your problem was, therefore, you gave a misleading financial because you issued a financial that showed no provision for the taxes and did not recognize this liability. But you knew at that point that, in fact, you couldn't sustain it, and you should have known, would be the argument, at the end of the period that it was unsustainable. Now, the notice also goes on and makes clear that generally, unless the issue in question affects a timing issue, this is going to be recognized as a liability and not a deferred tax issue. So you're going to have a real part of your tax liability, including this potential assessment for taxes due. You're not allowed to bury it in deferred taxes. You can only use deferred taxes if the issue in question is impacting a timing issue. Now, the interpretation gives a number of disclosures that are found at paragraphs 20 to 21 of the interpretation. These include tabular disclosure of items related to those items coming into and those items going out of, you know, our assessment of what's likely tax benefits. We have to have a tabular display. We have to disclose specifically benefits that, if recognized, would change the effective tax rate of the enterprise. We also have to determine and disclose interest and penalties booked. Oh, I forgot to mention that, didn't I? If you presume you're going to lose the benefit, you have to determine what interest would be due and record that interest. As well, you must make a determination of where the enterprise would be subjected to penalties, and if it would, record those as well. You must disclose, therefore, how much each period you have as interest and penalties on presumed losses, shall we say, from IRS exams that we're presuming will happen before the statute runs out, even though we might really think they never will. And we must also disclose specifically the total amount shown on our balance sheet, or as FASB likes to say, the statement of financial position, but we must disclose our total accrual sitting on our balance sheet for those items for interest and penalties. You must disclose positions for which it is reasonably possible the unrealized benefits will change in the next 12 months. Specifically, that obviously means those items for which the statute will expire within 12 months. Because even though we now believe we're presuming the IRS will examine us, that is, let us presume the statute would expire the day after the year ends. Nevertheless, as of the year end, we're presuming the IRS came in the midnight that night and issued the exam notice and made the assessment. based upon that, we'd have it, but we'd have to disclose in the financial statement that we expect that benefit to change, because once a statute has expired, and I shouldn't say we expect it to change, it is reasonably possible, because it would appear always reasonably possible if there's no exam started, that the IRS will not challenge the issue. As we're all fairly well aware, if we're getting to the last few months of a statute, the IRS is not terribly likely to come in and raise the issue. They prefer to come in while there's still statute time remaining, and only if they started an examination on something else and then decided to expand this year would we have a potential problem. So we may even know by the time the financial statement is issued that the statute has expired. But again, based upon the issue we noted above, you can't use that to justify not record, to justify recording the benefit in the prior year. You have to wait till the statute expires, but you will disclose in your financial statements that we reasonably think the our perception may change. That might also be true if a court case was pending and you knew that the result of that court case was going to make a significant impact on your belief as to whether it was more likely than not you would be sustained. In that case, you would probably also have to disclose if you reasonably thought that that case might be decided within the 12-month period. Finally, you must disclose the tax year subject to examination by the various taxing authorities. So a standard disclosure in your financial statement is going to be how many years are still open in each taxing authority. Now, that means all significant taxing authorities. Note that state statutes are often different than federal. Now, what's the effective date of this? Well, the effective date is for fiscal years beginning after December 15th, 2006. So for calendar year entities, that means 2007 will be the first year that you would apply it. The FASB encourages earlier application. They may encourage it. I'm not sure how many people are going to volunteer for this one. Note that the change in accounting method will be reported as a cumulative change effect. So you're going to see an adjustment to retained earnings to bring all of your old positions in. You don't ignore old positions. You have to go back, look at all positions taken on still open returns, and potentially book your liabilities on the items that you don't believe meet the 50% criterion on any of those returns. Now, FASB goes on behind the interpretation and offers various examples. Now, the first example they deals with an issue that involved asset capitalization. And this goes back to the issue of, let's say, a position where it would appear that the law provides for one result, but you believe reasonably, based upon what the service has done in the past, and I think that's the point they're trying to get at, that a different result might be obtained. And in this case, on A12, they were saying an enterprise established a capitalization threshold of $2,000 for its return. Assets purchased for less than $2,000 are claimed as expenses in the period in which they're purchased. Now, as we're aware, the tax law provides no such threshold. Management, however, believes, based on previous experience at a similar enterprise and discussions with the tax advisor, though, that the taxing authority will not attempt to disallow these expensings below $2,000. Based upon the case law, for instance, it appears that won't be a problem if there's not a huge number of such transactions. Now, that said, we can argue that maybe the law does support that because of accounting methods, but we'll skip and go over this. Now, they go on to note, though, some might deem the enterprise capitalization policy a technical violation of the tax law, since the law does not prescribe thresholds. However, in this situation, the enterprise concluded the capitalization policy is consistent with the demonstrated administrative practices and precedents of the taxing authority and practices of other entities that are regularly examined by it. So what this makes clear is you can consider the fact that the IRS does not normally assert here, even though they could assert on this issue, but the IRS regularly, when in full knowledge of the situation and fully aware of what's going on, does not assert, then that can be reasonably considered. That's basically a precedent based upon the IRS's actions in the past. That's not the same as saying it would work in a case where the IRS wasn't aware of or just didn't notice. This is presuming the IRS comes in, they clearly see your capitalization policy, and they don't worry about it. They have said consistently, we're not going to worry about this $2,000 capitalization policy you have. Now, paragraph A14 is a little bit more interesting. In this case, we have an issue of an enterprise that has been incorporated in jurisdiction A. This is a nexus problem. We've worked in A for 50 years. We have some operations in B for 20 years. It said we filed returns there for 20, but we're not sure of the exact time we really gained nexus and would have been liable under that particular area's rules. Now we come into an interesting problem. In this case, they point out that nexus, since no return was filed, the statute never closes. We would have to presume that the taxing authority would become aware now of the fact that we had not filed returns for those years. And based on that assumption, we would have to then conclude, is there going to be an assertion of liability? And we have to determine, is it more likely than not, based upon what really happened in the years we didn't file a tax return, that no return was due? By the way, the interpretation makes clear, failure to file a return is a tax return position. I took a position, let us say, when I filed the tax return for my corporation, because I didn't file a return in Rhode Island. Well, most likely because I didn't do anything anywhere near Rhode Island, but that's still a position I took that I didn't have to file in Rhode Island. The FASB points out that is a tax return position and you must evaluate. The interpretation makes clear as well that you have to remember that failing to file a return means the statute always stays open. And that means, at least theoretically, for nexus issues, you have potential exposure forever on those issues unless you could establish under administrative practices that the taxing entity in question doesn't go back that far. That can be an argument you could try, but clearly they mentioned nexus here specifically, and I certainly wouldn't want to be in a case where nexus got asserted in open years and you tried to hide behind the fact where you didn't think they'd assert that far back. Now, a very interesting example is found at A19, where the staff notes that it appears the way they measure this, they talk about highly certain tax positions. Now, an enterprise has a position it believes is based on clear and convincing law. Therefore, there's no issue. Therefore, it says it's clear and convincing. Now, it goes on to discuss that, well, it's difficult to determine what's an uncertain position, so that the enterprise has decided all positions must be evaluated under this interpretation. Now, I find that interesting because I don't really find anywhere in the interpretation itself the term uncertain tax positions is ever mentioned. But this goes on to say the staff realizes, though, that since it's difficult to do that, it would be reasonable to conclude all positions are covered. And then they go back and say we can exclude this for sure position. Let's say, for instance, paying the salary for people who are clearly doing business work. There's no question. Those are positions that are still positions, but we've evaluated they're 100% good. Therefore, we can recognize the full benefit. Practical matter is that suggests that for most of us, we'll have to presume all positions are covered and then work your way back out. The danger of that is it kind of suggests that if you're ever examined and you lose, the taxpayer gives up on a position, has an assessment. There's an argument that the financial statements were misstated at that time because you obviously had a position you didn't prevail in. Now, what kind of issues does this raise for the local practitioner and even for non-CPAs? Well, first problem, and this is something everybody needs to consider, even if you don't do tax, even if you don't do anything with accounting and auditing, you have to realize if your client requires a GAAP basis financial statement that requires full disclosure, and they're going to issue a full disclosure financial statement that follows these terms in detail because they have to be compliant, the notes to the financial statement and the financial statement itself is essentially going to provide a roadmap to the IRS on how to examine this return, and specifically those items that the taxpayer believes have a less than 50% chance of prevailing, or under the statistical mode, how much they're willing to give up or how much they believe they're going to give up on exam. Many of you may not be comfortable with that scenario. I know a number of people won't be. But realize, if you are reporting, if you have GAAP financials, this will now be the rule. A second issue for local CPAs will have to worry about, what's the impact on OCBOA? That is, other comprehensive bases of accounting statements. Well, as we know from the SASs, which is the Statements on Auditing Standards, which are referenced also in the Compilation and Review Standards, when you have a statement prepared on a basis of accounting other than GAAP, your disclosure tests are all, or your disclosure requirements are going to be similar for similar items. That suggests you're going to have a similar level of disclosure. You're going to have to put forward your uncertain positions. As well, it may be argued that even on items where you're talking about simple measurement issues, such as the tax liability, are you allowed to use the tax liability on the tax return? Or will you now have to evaluate that based on the 50% rule and therefore still reserve, if you have an accrual basis OCBOA statement that is income tax basis, will you still have to consider and essentially be charged with reserving for any amount that is an uncertain tax position? Finally, clearly this raises a very serious problem for CPAs with potential malpractice, especially for hindsight. Accountants can find themselves into a real problem if the client is assessed, because now the issue is not going to be the FASB 5 test of, was it, you know, basically, could we get out of this because at the time it didn't appear to be probable for the assessment. Now the question is going to be, we can't say we were assuming, you know, the odds were it wouldn't be looked at. There are all kinds of reasons why this wouldn't happen. Now we have to say that given the assumption the IRS would know about this and would examine the return and would have all details, was it reasonable to conclude that there was a less than 50% chance that we'd have an assessment? In this case, it appears with hindsight, a lot of juries may presume the answer will be no. You should have known that this particular issue was going to be raised. You should have known that an assessment was possible, and you should have recorded the liability against it. What's the CPA's responses then? As well as, what's the issues we're going to face for non-CPAs? Well, CPAs need to remember one deal. We always have to remember the division that the financial statement is the client's, the report, or in the case of an audit, the opinion, is the accountant's. One solution to this problem is the financial statement simply does not include these items, and the accountant's report gives a notation of a departure from generally accepted accounting principles based on this. That departure needs to be mentioned on audits, reviews, compilations, and quite honestly, even inside CPAs that are presenting financial statements to outsiders, which claim to be GAAP, and most and users will be allowed to presume in general cases you are presenting a GAAP statement, we'll also need to note this non-compliance to keep from being misleading. The issue becomes Ethics Section 91.02, when you combine that with Section 203.1, indicates essentially if a CPA is associated with a financial statement, you're going to end up being able to presume GAAP unless told otherwise. So even internal CPAs will have to worry about this. What if you're not an accountant? Well, attorneys are going to face an issue here because if their clients are being audited, we have audited financial statements, or even we have other types of financial statements, reviews, etc. The client may be told by the accountant that this tax position, they need to show a reason why there's a greater than 50% chance of expecting to have it sustained, presuming it's examined. Those clients may very well turn to their tax attorney to obtain that assurance. And while we all know that you're asking for something very significant when you're going to ask for this opinion letter, reality is many of your clients believe, I just need this piece of paper signed by you and my accountant gets off my back. The same issue many accountants have run into on the mortgage issue, where the mortgage company, the client comes in and says, the mortgage guy just says, I need this letter signed by you that says I've been self-employed. And that gets them off my back. And what's your problem with signing that letter? So essentially, we may find some pressure and some back pressure on these issues. You may also find that, as we've noted, you have to understand that your client's going to be forced to indicate and basically come forward if they understand there's less than a 50% chance. So if you have, in fact, in discussing it with your client, said, I didn't conclude there was a greater, I didn't conclude it's more likely than not, but it's a good enough position that we can take it and it's acceptable on the return, there won't be penalties, that's fine. But now the client is aware of a less than 50% chance of sustaining, presuming that the issue is examined. So that information is going to potentially need to appear on the client's financial statement, or frankly, if it doesn't, the client is committing a fraud when they give that financial statement to a lender who then tries to use that, not understanding that there's a gap departure because the liability was not reserved against. Finally, it will be very important for all of us to train our clients and our staff about what this means. This provision is becoming effective beginning for fiscal years beginning after December 16th, 2006. As such, next year we need to start recording this. When you do the first interim financial statements next year for a 2007 calendar year client, you're going to have to start booking this particular issue and under these rules. You're going to have to pick up the cumulative effect immediately. So for clients who are going to be subject to this rule, you're probably going to need to compute that cumulative effect at the end of this year. And you're going to have to educate clients about that deal. You may need to discuss carefully with clients whether they're going to want to do that or whether it might make more sense to just accept having a departure noted in the accountant's report. And they may need to talk with their bankers or others who read the financial statements and who are relying upon them to understand why that departure is going to be in the report and to make sure that's not a problem. Finally, note the difference that we have between what's going on here and what will go on if we have a position that potentially raises a couple of issues and whether there might be a tax or a non-tax liability. For this case, I want to refer you to the case of Chow versus Malkani, which is an ERISA case that recently came down from the Fourth Circuit on June 22nd. That particular case involved interpretation of employee benefit plan and the potential liability from the employer to the plan for amounts not paid. Now, as we all know, employee benefit plans also have tax impact, and there are tax positions with the deductibility of those contributions. And as we discovered in the neonatology case, if we are, let's say, making excess contributions for the highly compensated and we're not making contributions for the others, in neonatology this involved an employee benefit plan, not a qualified plan, but the similar rule would seem to apply here, that would have become and did become in neonatology a dividend, which of course had a direct impact on their tax return because the position was taken that it was not an ordinary necessary business expense and it was not authorized as compensation, therefore no deduction was allowed for a compensation deduction based on those issues. Now that was interesting because it suggests when we look at the Chow versus Malkani case that this illustrates the difference between FASB 5 and the Interpretation 48 issue on taxes. Malkani eventually got stuck with a liability of over $700,000 to fund to their plan. Had Malkani instead faced a $700,000 tax liability, we would have evaluated things differently under this rule. Under the rule that we deal with normally under FASB 5, this potential liability, which now appears becoming more real since the Fourth Circuit has agreed it's there, you would have analyzed that each year on the financial statements based upon whether it was likely that a claim would be asserted, and if asserted, then was it likely we would lose and what would be our liability. But you could consider the likelihood of assertion of the claim. So that means if we had presumed, let's say, and it's probably not a very unknown secret, shall we say, that there probably are a lot of small plans out there, especially small SEPs, where contributions have been made to the highly compensated and they've excluded people who should have been covered that just go by the wayside because there's low compliance, there's no reporting, and basically a lot of things tend to happen there and never get examined. But if that had gone on, and if we had presumed at that point it was likely, you know, there was a low likelihood of a report being filed or an issue being filed, we could have ignored recording that liability. But if we had considered the tax side, that was a potential tax liability, in that scenario, under Malkani, you would have recorded the liability up front until the statute expired. Because in that case, you could not any longer talk about whether the liability would be asserted. You had to talk about now whether or not the claim, not whether the claim would be raised or anybody would ever notice there's a claim, but rather presume the examination and presume all facts are in the face of the examining agent. So if we're looking at examining agent from the Internal Revenue Service as opposed to the Department of Labor, then we would have to book that even though it seems unlikely that we will ever face a liability. That difference is going to be tough to explain and may be very difficult, but please remember, under these rules, you are no longer looking at the FASB 5 tests for purposes of tax liabilities. We now have a more likely than not test. Again, you should go to the FASB website, get interpretation number 48 and read it. You have implementation time coming in now. You need to be ready for this. As well, consider how this impacts you even if you don't do audits. As CPAs who do compilations, we always have to consider the stated qualification of the client's accounting personnel. That means we won't necessarily be able to just take their assertion that, in fact, everything is fine on the tax angle. We have to understand, do they know enough and is there competence there to be able to reasonably expect they would be able to sustain the position and have the records in question? Do we expect that they really are keeping, for instance, the auto logs that would be necessary to sustain their deduction? Under the tax law, we basically have to inform them and make an inquiry, are you doing this? But under the tax standards, we don't have to actually go see them. However, under this rule, if we have reason to believe that they may not be, in essence, that their accounting background may not be good enough to make this proper, then we have a problem. Second, in many cases, as the CPA doing the financial reporting and doing the tax work, the client is relying upon the CPA to come to the conclusion of whether there's a greater than 50% chance. That means that the CPA is going to basically, by his silence, if he does not have a departure from GAAP paragraph and he does not disclose and record this liability, the CPA is essentially saying there is a greater than 50% chance or more likely than not position for every item on the return that the CPA is aware of. That may open up some real issues for liability. This has been Tax Update. As noted, Tax Update is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. We'll welcome you. Hopefully you've enjoyed this and have some fun and have some reading material to work with now. And we'll be talking to you in the future as we do a more tax update.